Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
But yeah, it was just weird going to school and running into kids that say like, oh, I don't really listen to music. I was like, what? You don't breathe? Like it didn't make any sense to me.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Lowell, I'm just going to introduce our guest today is Mason Silver, Skateboarder of the Year. You've already met Mason, I think. You've already seen him in action. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, the first time I saw Mason skate in person, I was up in the High Sierras. We went over to the park there and he was skating, and it was one of the most transcendent experiences of my life because he was doing these kind of amazing tricks effortlessly. That's what it looked like. I mean, I saw his face close up, you know, 10 foot away, and it's like he's just completely in the moment, completely in the flow of it all. And obviously, you know, that's not true because it takes a lot of skill to do it, but he's like so completely in the moment. It was a wonderful thing to experience. So, how's it feel, Skater of the Year?
How did it feel? It was a dream of mine since I was young, but it was something that was so far away that it seemed like it could never happen. So, it definitely still doesn't feel real, and I'm not even really sure if I could have an answer to that question for a long time, because if it doesn't feel real, I'm sure I'm not going to even realize what to say about it.
That's amazing. I'm trying to think what it's like. It's like winning a Grammy or something.
Yeah. Right?
So when did you like, you know, when did you first have like, you know, that's what I want to do?
I think around maybe 12 or 13 years old was when I really first started to try and film videos and put them out on the internet. And so from that age, I was just realizing that this was kind of the apex of where you could go doing that. And there were so many levels in between that though, that I was just like, oh, you know, it'll be long in the future. But yeah, I can't believe it happened at I think this is young for it to happen, I guess. And yeah, I'm really happy.
Has your mum been behind you all the way?
It was definitely, I think, maybe a little weird when the first time that I said I wanted to do independent studies at school and just go on skate trips instead. But once they saw the people behind me at the companies and they knew that this could actually be a career, they were behind it. Yeah.
That was like that with my mum until she saw me in like the papers with, you know, The Clash. And there's my son standing next to this in this picture. So something must be working, you know, and then they kind of got it. We all operate outside the normal realms of you know, proper society, if you like. It's like we're not doctors, we're not lawyers, we're doing something different.
Yeah, you know, at the beginning, it's hard to show them anything because you might get a gig that you're excited about, but they don't care who you're opening. They don't know who you're opening for. They don't know.
Will you be home tonight or are you staying away?
Yeah.
Mason, it's very interesting what you were saying about what it meant to you to be Skater of the Year and how you started skating. You said, well, it came about when you were 12 or 13. And I think Buddy will probably tell you that that's about the same time as it happens for us for music. Yeah. About 12 or 13, you start thinking, hey, I can do something with this. Like, you know, you've been listening to it for a few years. Like, you've been watching people skateboard. You've been there. Yeah. But about 12 or 13, you really decide when you're playing music, hey, this is what I want to do. And like, I better get serious. I mean, I think at 13, I got Buddy Rich's Book of Snare Drum Rudiments out the library because I was serious at that point.
Yeah.
So how was it for you? When was like the combination of music and skateboarding? How did that come together? That's what we want to know.
Yeah, because I think around that same age as when you were saying you would have got that book was when I first started really paying attention to how skate videos are made and how the songs can really complement the person and kind of take the skateboarding to another level.
But yeah, it was just weird going to school and running into kids that say like, oh, I don't really listen to music. I was like, what, you don't breathe? Like, it didn't make any sense to me. So yeah, it's just been really cool to get introduced to the stuff that I still listen to today from such an early age, you know?
Yeah.
I definitely don't think I would have found out about half the music I listen to today if it wasn't for skate videos.
Am I right in thinking that you, at that point, you couldn't pop down to the local library and pick out a book that said, here's how you make a video for your skate?
I think that's also another good comparison between the two worlds. Is that it's like anything in the mainstream wasn't what you wanted to hear or see. And yeah, there wasn't anything that you could go and directly do. It was almost this feeling of like, you know, it's exclusive, you know, it was hard to find the things that you wanted to find. And I think that made it like, it made me want to do it more.
It sounds, because when we were starting off as well, like musicians in the backwoods, you know, the back of beyond, you know, there was the concrete, whatever it was factories of the northwest of England for me, you know. But we were like presented with a world that we're thinking, how on earth do we get into that world? How do we break in?
Mm-hmm.
Was there no, sort of high benchmark, high bar that you had to get to? Or was it like, I don't even want to go there?
I think, well, how you're saying like breaking into the world, that's what's a hard thing to navigate in skateboarding. And I don't know if it's the same in music, is that you can, oftentimes someone can try too hard and it looks bad and you have to really like know how to navigate the industry and not just try and barge your way through the door, you know? And yeah, I don't know if this is that the same in music where it's like, you almost don't want to try too hard around some of those people.
Lol.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we kind of did the opposite a bit. We did the barging in, you know, because that's what punk was. Punk was up
true.
Barging into the mainstream music business because, you know, I can remember going to see bands starting off, you know, seeing the Clash, seeing the Stranglers and thinking,
yeah,
okay, we can do this. We don't have to be like, you know, super proficient at stuff. We just have to, what's the old saying they say about blues, you know, all you need is three chords and the truth. And that's what we felt. So
I think like we knew who not to hang around with.
Yes.
If you like, yeah, but you put the words into my mouth, I remember the people who were trying too hard.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's really easy to see through that, you know.
The ones that had gone down to London to get the right gear, you know, and come back. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, because a lot of skating is acting like you don't care, you know. And so I don't know if that's the same, that too, you know. Yeah. You have to kind of have this facade that you're, you know, kind of just shrugging everything off and don't really care, and but maybe deep down you do, but you can't show it.
That definitely helps in some mm-hmm. ways.
If I think back to a band like Wire, you know, but they came on and each song was like probably over within 2 minutes or 3 minutes. There was nothing long.
Yeah.
There was no lighting. There was really no indication that they really wanted to be there.
Yeah.
But whilst they were there, it was intense.
Yeah.
You know, not caring about things, realizing we were marginalized outside of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
It helped us most of the time because we were like, a little gang, and we were like a little unit, and we could go anywhere and we'd just do our thing, like play our songs. And if you liked them, that was great. And we met a lot of good people that way. But if you didn't, or if you were bemused by it, it kind of didn't matter to us so much because we didn't have such a high bar.
And you realized that was okay, you know?
Yeah, it was okay because some people got it and some people just didn't. We had this hard punk attitude. We don't care, you know? Mm-hmm. Just going to play our stuff and do it. And that saved us because otherwise we probably wouldn't have come back. We would have thought, oh, no, we can't do this.
You know? Exactly. You have to have that thicker skin to know. And that's the thing about skating is someone from the outside might not really know anything about skating, but all you really want to hear is the people who actually skateboard, because you understand that these other people don't actually really get it.
When did you find your gang? You know, the guys that who understood and you understood each other?
Yeah, it seemed like everyone in my direct grade in school didn't really skate the way that I wanted to think about. They didn't think about skating the way I did. They didn't go to sleep thinking about it and wake up thinking about it like I did. It was kind of just something that if they were bored, they would skate to the store or something like that. But I found a friend, Jared Cleland, who was 2 years older than me, and I still skate with him almost every day to this day. And he was kind of on that same level, and he would show me new videos and stuff, and he was definitely a good influence on me. So it definitely drew me to that older crowd that knew a little more, and I just was so eager to learn everything through them.
Did you have to travel to meet these people? Or were they like in your neighborhood, or did you have to go somewhere else?
Oh, he grew up like 5 blocks from me.
Wow.
Yeah. But no, I definitely met a lot of people through traveling to contests, and people that I still know today, like meeting at a young age of 14. And it's just really cool to see that now this person that I just met when I was 14, we're both pro skaters now 10 years later, you know, and it's just really cool to see it grow.
Wow. That's akin to us kind of jumping in the van for the first time and traveling like, you know, 40, 50 miles to the next city. And realizing, hey, there's a club like the club we have, you know, with a few people. And there's all those people who are hangers-on, and there's the people who might be okay. And that, you know, you've got this filtration thing on, you know,
you're filtering out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is it kind of whittling down who I'm going to spend my time to and who I'm going to not waste my time with?
A huge part of skating is, especially when you're filming, is you're doing such scary stuff, you just have to have the honest filmer that will tell you how it looks. You have to have your friend there to help you do it. You know, like you just have to have the right people around you. And that's seems like that would correlate perfectly to having a band. You know, you have to have people that you can really feed off of and be honest with without them getting offended or, you know.
Yeah, it's tricky. Very tricky.
I'm sure it can get really tricky. Yeah.
You have a good crew.
Yeah. You definitely see the people, and you can kind of, when you see them, you might think like, oh, I know exactly how long they're going to be around, and I know how long they're going to be around, and you see how people think, and it's like how long they drink the night before or something like that. You know, you can really tell like that. Maybe that's not the best person to go on a trip with, you know.
I would have been that person. I would have been that
person. There's similarity, LOL, because you met Robert at the bus stop and Mason had a guy a few blocks away. So, like, you found your kind of buddy, you know, the guy who's going to stick around pretty early on, right?
Yeah, I don't really know what I would have done if it was just me at that age. I feel like I could have gotten just influenced by different things. Are you and Robert were the same age?
Oh yeah. We went to school from 5 years old. So yeah, we were the same. I'm a little bit older than him. I'm the senior.
Yes, of course. Get that one in.
I met him when I was 5, and then, you know, what do? You hang out at birthday parties, you know, for a few years when you're that age, and then about 12 or 13, we're like, hey, you like music? Yeah, I like music. Me too.
Yeah, because when you're young and we're, you know, 14 and we don't really have sponsors and we're not paid to travel anywhere. We just spend our own money and we go and do it ourselves. And we really do feel like that band, you know, we're just all together and we came from the same place and we have all the same interests and all the inside jokes, everything.
Right.
And I remember some of the first skate trips was we were maybe 16 or 17, all staying in one Motel 6 room, 10 of us, just on the floor, spread out, just 10 yeah. people.
Hey, just like touring.
That's going. Hang on, hold up. Motel 6, that's luxury, you know. Like, oh, in the set, you had a room. Let me tell you about touring in a like a you know a little Ford van, like with all your gear yeah. in England when it's like winter and you're sleeping on top of a mattress on top of the cabinets, you know, like
yeah. you're lucky you had a mattress.
You wake up in the morning and you hope that nobody moves because if they move, the breath that has condensed on the roof of the van will drip on everybody.
No. Yeah,
but it's all great fun.
But then the minute one of us gets a different sponsor, we have to go on trips without everyone, and that's the weirdest thing. Is like you're almost thrown into a van with people that you don't really know that much, and you kind of just have to adapt. So it's that's the one difference, is like you're not necessarily always around those people.
Ooh, so it's like it could be a stable of kindred spirits with the same sponsor, or you're on your own.
Exactly, and you still have those friends, but it's not like you're going to be with them every single day.
Well, how's that work out for you?
It was weird at first going into vans and kind of you just really second guess everything. Like you're like, oh, are they thinking, are they looking at me? Are they, you know, what do they think of me? And yeah, there's just definitely been, cause I was in vans on trips when I was 15 or 16. And so obviously I probably said some things that, you know, turned some people away.
I've become a kind of a new skateboard geek, I think.
I like that.
I really like the gear. I've been watching a lot of the first guy who skated in long trousers. I'm not going to say pants because it means...
Corey?
Yes, I think like Corey.
Corey Duffel.
But it was... I just thought that the gear also seems to change as well, and depending who you're with, yeah?
Yeah, it was... I mean, in just time periods, because... all of the 90s was huge baggy pants, and then all of the 2000s was tiny skinny pants, and then now it's back to baggy. It just changes so much, yeah.
I'm in the middle. I'm changing. I don't know where I'm changing into. Yeah. I'm looking for baggy, you know, baggy but smart.
Yeah, but not too baggy, yeah.
Okay, I'm taking a tip. Not too baggy, right. So I was watching, like, these skateboard videos. What do you call them? Like, you know, clips and things.
Yeah, clips, videos.
Parts,
there you go.
And what I really noticed was the editing. Mm-hmm. What was amazing was the way the tricks, the way they were cut, not exactly to the beat necessarily. Mm-hmm. It was like the way you interpreted the music, as if beats were, okay, I can land on that beat, or... Mm-hmm.
Or the beat can, like lead to another thing, or it can flow in a certain way. Yeah, but that would be the most traditional way, is like drum beats are usually going to be seen as landing marks, you know, and that can make the landing seem so much more powerful when it has the right beat to land on.
Do you get involved in the editing and cutting? Oh, of the,
a lot. Yes, I do. I'm in the editing bay with pretty much most of my parts, but I like to be there listening for the small beats and stuff that might work. And a lot of the order of tricks, knowing that how much effort it took me to do the trick, I like to have those kind of closer to the end. And I'm a control freak.
Yeah.
When you're doing your parts, do you do it like we would do a set of songs? You know, like if we've got 20 songs to play, We start off with a couple of that are going to grab your attention.
That's exactly the same way. Yeah, I would say some of those, and I would think maybe in the middle of the set would be something that might bring your attention back, and then it could be something that is more of a deeper cut that could be something that, right, you know, is for like the true fans. And that's how I feel like some of the editing is in skateboarding for sure. But you, especially now with people's attention span,
yeah,
is you want to have something right at the beginning to keep them in there, you know, because yeah, they might just click away right instantly,
right,
if they don't recognize it or think it's cool.
How long is that actual period of time for grabbing somebody's attention?
You know, yeah, I would say 15 seconds nowadays with the way that Instagram is.
Wow.
You know, people scroll through their feed on their Instagram and they see it, right, and then they're sure, like, nope, and they just, yeah, go past it so quick.
Right. Wow.
It's weird. It's times are changing and there's so much out there that people don't have time for everything.
You know, like in the 80s, if you had your song played on the radio or whatever, it would take like 3 goes of somebody hearing it before they might go out and get it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And now it's like about 12 times because there's so much stuff out there. It's just impossible to get into everybody's heads, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
There's a song deep to my heart that apparently you love to skate to.
I found out about a lot of music from skate videos, oh, and I think that monitor off of Juju was probably the biggest one. That song is so good to skate to. I just love that, wow, song.
Oh my God.
it just gets me in the right mood to skate every time that I listen to it.
Wow. I'm just blown away to hear that. Can I give you a little insight to that song?
Mm-hmm.
It was like a live studio jam. Mm-hmm. John McGeoch had the detuned guitar part, the big open string.
Mm-hmm.
The drum beat was pure Bonham. It, you know, I was here, I was kind of channeling that 2 beats on the bass drum. Boom, God, boom, God, boom. I tried that beat in a few other things, and it never, but then this one, it locked in.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a moment, and I can feel the shiver now just thinking back, because the vocals were done live. Susie was over in a vocal screened off bit. And we didn't really have an arrangement, but it just kept stopping. And when it stopped, McGeoch would start again. And it was, then I heard Helter Skelter by the Beatles in my head.
Ah.
And it was like, dap, 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 dap.
That's, I mean, I think that's a big part of the song too, is that the pacing is pretty much the same for the whole song. Like it's,
yeah,
just this like heavy jam song that feels like, you know, it just feels like a perfect song to put on when you and your friends are just skating, because it is such a, it just matches the jam format.
God, we'd never have known. Could you imagine?
No, I'm sure you guys wrote it for skating, didn't you? Yeah.
This is going to be great. This is going to kill him in California.
Mm-hmm.
I remember like the place when I was growing up that I really wanted to play was in New York, you know. Then I wanted to play Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
So where was the place that you really wanted to go skate and you really wanted to be, that had the same sort of mystical appeal for you?
New York is definitely a place that skaters from the West Coast want to go to, because all growing up there's these things that you hear are like, oh, New York is so hard to skate. There's traffic everywhere and it's rough and it's just impossible to try and film anything there. And then that kind of makes you be like, well, I think I could, you know. It's definitely a proving ground. Like if you can film stuff in New York, you've made it, you know. It's like a real street skater's place to film.
Yeah, that's good insight. I mean, you know, I guess what's it they say, you know, if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. It's just, I don't know if there's places like that in music, but like, yeah, just where it's hard to maybe get into certain places or venues, you know. It's like,
yeah, there's certain places that when I played there I felt, oh, okay, I've arrived. And then there's certain places that weren't like that, like when I was like, you know, 16, I used to go to this club in London and I used to look at the doors at the side of the stage and think, oh, I bet it's really exciting behind there.
Mm-hmm.
And fast forward a few years, we played the place and I went, opened the doors, and it was just a fire escape. No, nothing, you know.
That's hilarious. So where would you guys say is the like harshest critics out of anywhere?
For us, the harshest critics were here where I am now, not in Berlin, but in like some, I think it was Dortmund or Frankfurt, here in Germany.
Yeah, Germany.
I don't know what it was. We'd go on and like everything we did that would like in any other place, they'd be kind of storming the stage.
Oh my God.
In Germany, they were stood there kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. And your next song is?
Yeah.
I know that a bit because you're right. Because the first time I played in Berlin at SO36 or whatever, like this little club, it was packed, absolutely packed. And we did the same thing. We played and it was just like, yes, okay. And at the end, everybody went nuts. But that happened in Japan as well. But that's.
Ah, the first time in Tokyo, wherever it was, lol. You could on stage. You could hear the sound of the amps.
Oh yeah.
If I got a key and tensioned to my snare drum, it went, and you could hear it around the club, club. And you finished every song and like nothing. You're like, oh shit, they hate it. This is we're dying here. And then you get to the end of your set. And they'd got crazy and clap and scream and scream, and like the Beatles have arrived.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very different way of appreciating music. I mean, I appreciate it, but just in a completely different way. I mean, in North America and Europe and Australia, it's pretty much the same. You know, they slightly different accent, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same place.
Yeah, it's the same place. You might as well be playing the same place. Yeah.
We were used to being, you know, abused on stage. Where like people just heckling, shouting, and throwing things, you know.
Really? Throwing things?
Yeah, even after the gobbing had stopped, you know, the gobbing, the spitting out of appreciation.
I could not imagine if someone did that in a skate demo or something. I don't think that's ever happened.
How we survived without hepatitis, I'll never know.
Many didn't. Yeah. But we came to America, and they had cigarette lighters up in the audience going like, they like us.
Yeah.
We're doing something wrong. Must be.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a knife edge, you know, because on one hand, you want to be outside of the mainstream, because I'm getting the feeling, talking to you, like skateboarding and the kind of music that me and Budgie have done over our lives is outside of the mainstream.
Yeah.
But you also want to be acknowledged a little bit that you're okay and it's valid. You know, it's valid. Where was there any time when you come against anybody who's like, oh, that's what you do, and you felt like, not disrespected, but you felt like they don't really understand what it is I'm doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when I was around, like, probably at the end of high school, and I hadn't really traveled for skating yet, but it was taking up all of my time, it seemed like maybe it was more of just other friends' parents would chime in sometimes and say, aren't you going to college? And I was like, no, I think everything's going to work out after high school and it's going to start speeding up once I don't have school to do. And they're like, it's just such a scary thought for people that don't, that's just all they know is like you go to college and then you get out and you probably don't even use your degree for what your actual job is. And then it's like, I don't know. It's strange.
When do you think you kind of got that feeling that, you know, this is going to be, fulfills me. This is like, even if nobody wants to see it or hear it or pay me for it.
Yeah. I think, man, around maybe right when I got out of high school, I went to Barcelona the first summer after, and that trip was just like, it was monumental for sure. Like, it made me realize that, like, no matter what was happening with skating or how much money I was making, if I was able to go and do that with my friends, that was all that mattered. Like, it's still one of the best memories of my life, was just going there with my friends for the first time.
Right.
Do you guys think that you could ever just stop thinking about writing music at ever? Like, because that's the thing about skating is I couldn't understand myself just walking away from everything, you know? Is it possible for you guys to even do that?
I got here 10 years ago. I've been in Berlin 10 years. And when I got here, everything I knew about the band I'd had, the life I've had to that point, and it's a long time. It was over 20, maybe about 20 years. It all gone. It stopped. And I thought, okay, this really is it. And it's not like I tried to walk away. I thought I was shown the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then as much as I tried to be in LA. I remember coming to LA thinking, this is how I'm going to break into LA.
Yeah.
Nope. No, that wasn't going to work. The more I tried, the more I was pulled in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Sometimes I suppose I have to go, I just need to be where I need to be and see what happens next.
Yeah.
Yeah. The book kind of saved me and put me back into a mind for music, because I never stopped, but I got sort of more and more disheartened by things. And it got to a point, I suppose, 7 or 8 years ago, a friend of mine said, you know, do you want to write a book? Because you said you wanted to write a book. And I thought, okay, well, you know, it's not music, but I can do something with this. And the aspect of writing a book was so life-altering for me, because I found, you know, it was just the same art, but with a different name, you know, a different way of doing it. And I had the same feelings, and that rekindled the fire, that relit the fire. So yeah, the answer to your question really for me is no, it never goes away. If you're really inside of it, it can never go away. It can't go away until the day you die, you know. It's always going to be there.
It's like if you see someone walk away from it, you instantly think differently of them. You're like, well, how could they just stop thinking about it? Or, you know, it's just it's part of us for sure, you know.
The grand obsession. It has to be.
Yeah, like exactly. Yeah. It has to be, or else, you know, it can't be great.
I started to realize, as much as the hour on stage and the endless hours traveling, what became important was meeting people before, afterwards, meeting people from where I was, finding out, what's it like living here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you guys do at night? You know, where do you go?
Mm-hmm.
And that became like a fascination.
Mm-hmm. You know, because it's one thing to hear from a skateboarder that, oh, your part was great. Or, you know, it's one thing to hear from another musician that, oh, yeah, your album was great. But, you know, when you see someone randomly on the street and they get to tell you and they say like, oh, I don't even really skate that much, but I discovered your part, you know, it means so much more, and that can inspire you for so much longer than hearing it from one of your, you know, fellow people.
Right.
So you're making connections.
Yeah.
You're joining lives together.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Just pulling bits in. That's mm-hmm. That's something that's really addictive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's just and it's really inspiring, you know, to hear that people are still trying to find new things to do.
Yeah.
You know,
I think skaters appreciate someone trying to find something new more than trying to do something better. New is cooler than better.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah.
That's really nice to hear.
The main thing that I want from my skateboarding is for someone to be, you know, they could just be born yesterday, but to, you know, 20 years later, to meet them and say that they like went back and watched my stuff and they still, you know, got inspired by it. That's the main goal.
Thank you so much, Mason.
I've had just a joy, really. I've learned so much, and I feel brilliant because you liked the music that I did.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah. Nice. Of course, I love like both of your guys' stuff. I think it just speaks perfect to skateboarders because of the way that you guys were going about it when you were making it. You know, it's so similar to the way that we had to do stuff when we were first skating, and it's all the same feelings and it's all the same energy. It's great.
Parting is such sweet sorrow. But Mason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mason.
It was an amazing conversation. I'm glad we could make those correlations between the worlds.
Look forward to the next peak.
As you guys.
Lol, it's curious question time.
We have some curious questions from the fans.
We have curious questions from curious creature fans. You dig deep. Get that big ball of roll. that tombola. Singing. Roller, bowler, bowler, penny a pitch. Okay. Spin the wheel. I'll spin the wheel. What's the first question this evening?
Okay. Here's a good one. This is from Stephen Carey. And I don't know where Stephen is. But he says, hi. I think it's actually from England, if I listen to this question, the way it's phrased.
Well, it's a good way of starting, isn't it? Hi.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah.
Hi.
But there's another bit in this question that's going to make you know that he's from England.
Okay.
It says, hi. Did either of you ever listen to something the other had done and thought, bugger, I wish I'd come up with that. Cheers. See.
The bugger gives it away.
Yes, I did hear a part of Budgie's playing where I thought, wow, I had wished I had come up with that. It's that part in the song, and I've got to think of the name of the song now.
Oh, on the spot. I am not going to put you on the spot. Oh, no. It's from each of our own songs, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah. And Happy House.
Oh, Happy House, yes. Remember it well. Was a rather good tune there. A rollicking bugger of a little song.
A bugger of a little song. That bit where Adam sings about the throwing them down the stairs.
Oh, now we just jump songs. We just jump songs.
Isn't that Happy House?
Happy House, we did boom, ticky boom, ticky boom, ticky boom, ticky boom. But the one down the stairs. Boom, 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 gap, boom, boom, boom.
That's it.
Ah.
No, I got you.
I thought it's spellbound.
Yes.
Don't forget when your neighbor forgets to say their prayers, take him by the leg. Throw them down the stairs. Boom, 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 bap.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yeah, that's, I like that.
I know you like that. Because I know the story. You've used the same stairwell.
Oh yes, in the record company's studio. Yeah,
Stratford Place, Polydor Studios.
Yes,
and there was a stairwell, and we put the drums in the stairwell. You may have even played the stairwell itself.
I played the stairwell as it happened. Yeah, I think the reason I like it is because it's. Part of the song, it's not just the rhythmic underpinning, because it is literally, you know, it signals what happens in the song. And I always like that. Like when I was playing with the Cure, with Robert's vocals, a lot of the times I would try to accentuate things in the vocal with my playing, because that was the thing that was exciting to me, the vocal line. And so when I heard that, I heard you play that part, I thought, wow, that's pretty damn good. You know, it's like, it's part of the song.
Yeah. It's like looking for the drama.
Yes.
You know, trying to stretch it out somehow, you know, get yourself into the lyric. I'm totally with you. I just love the way you hit the little splash cymbal. I mean, it's the classic early Cure track is a forest.
Yes, right.
And it's, you know, boom, get, boom, get, boom, get, shh, get, boom,
get. Yes, it's a little simple. Yeah. You know, that cymbal came from St. Wilfrid's music room when I first had it. You know, I liberated it. They were never going to use it, so I liberated it. You know, some might call it stealing, but I don't think so. Oh. Maybe I should buy them one and send it back to them now.
You set it free for a new life.
I set it free for a new life, and it became part of our sound. And yeah, definitely, that's something that I've kept all the way along in my playing. I've kept a little splash cymbal somewhere just to do those little bits that fit in with the vocal.
Did you find that the splash cymbal? Did it expand to a Chinese cymbal? Like a bigger crash, but just as quick?
About the time of Pornography, yeah, because I went to Ray Mann's and I bought this huge buggery cymbal That was about the size of us. Yeah.
I have to explain. Ray Manz is the the Chinese. He was a Chinese musical instrument store in Covent Garden, in London, and we must have missed each other by minutes. Because I was down there as well. I still have singing bowls and lots of little things from Ray Manz's Chinese musical instrument store, which my my good wife tells me, you know, were probably cheap as chips, you know, in China, but cost a fortune in Covent Garden.
Right.
But I think, China cymbals came out as splashes.
Yeah, they did, because it was a very similar kind of sound, but much, much bigger and more mental. So... yeah, I think when I got to pornography and I bought that symbol, that was like, there's no going back there now. And like the splash, I still have a China type on my kit now.
The sound that I tried to introduce and got it in there whenever I could, I put the tambourine on the hi-hat.
Yes. Which
only afterwards did I see photographs of Mr. Bonham, and Mr. John Bonham with Led Zeppelin. He had Ching ring, it's called, a ching ring on the top of his hi-hat. And I'd heard it, but I didn't know what it was. And when I put one on mine and heard it, I went, oh my goodness, that's what it is. Loved it. Loved it, hitting it as a cymbal as well. Did we answer his question, Lol, do you think?
Sort of, yeah. I think we got his question.
Did we completely bugger it up?
Well, you might have buggered it up too. All right, I've got a second one here now. I don't know, this one's probably a bit contentious, and maybe I don't know, in the spirit of the era, probably not. Hello, love. I was at a Cure gig. This is from Russell in Sheffield, obviously.
Hi, Russell in Sheffield.
I was at a Cure gig in 1981 at the Top Rank in Sheffield.
Oh, lovely venue. Yes.
You did your set and came out for the encore. As you started playing, a couple of fans jumped up.
Whoa, hold it. Encore?
Yeah.
You were doing encores in Sheffield?
Yeah. Right to saw.
Oh, my goodness. You were doing well straight away.
Yeah. He says, as you started playing, a couple of fans jumped up on stage to dance. The bouncers flew onto stage, pushing these fans dangerously back into the crowd. Your guitarist and yourself... it's Reggie means Robert here, and then pushed the bouncers, quite rightly, across the stage when there was a fight between everyone. The bouncers appeared on stage, and the crowd were trying to get on stage. Obviously, you all had to get off stage safely, and the concert was ended. There was mayhem in the venue for about 10 minutes till it all died down.
Right.
We emerged covered in drink and were duly thrown out. I wonder if you have any recollections of that night. Sure, I have a ticket if you need proof. Thanks. Russell Banks, Sheffield, England. So
sounds like a regular night out to me, Lol.
Yeah, I mean, me and Budgie have got memories of early punk rock gigs, and they always got a little bit like that. I don't think it was anything tremendously unusual. Apart from the course, it was like usually people getting on stage who were, excited by the music and the atmosphere. And most of them were fine, And actually, most of the trouble always would come from the security in the places who were a little bit...
Around that time, if I remember correctly, there was always a kind of, a pressentiment, as the French would say. There was like mostly from, as you say, the security, who were not professional security.
No.
And they were used to a quiet gig and, they'd have a few pints. And suddenly all these youngsters would turn up looking a little odd, a little strange, and getting really worked up at the front of the stage. And there was no real way of, they hadn't figured out a plan.
No.
So it was all a bit rough-handed, and it was usually turned a bit, ugly.
I like that phrase there, rough-handed, because I do remember at one point we had it inserted in our contract with all these venues that, the Cure do not approve of bouncing, and nobody should be bounced out of the place, and we have our own crew who will take care of any situation should they arise, in a much more civilized fashion. I don't think it said civilized fashion, but basically the idea was we were not going to tolerate the fans being brutalized, you know?
Which we had the driver and two of the guys who went on to more illustrious careers in the protection racket in and around London's bigger venues.
Yeah.
But they, one of them was like a, you know, both of them were trained in some kind of close combat stuff is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
But what they used to do was stand about 3-4 rows into the audience,
yeah,
because that's where the troublemakers used to start hitting on the kids in front of them.
Yeah.
So they'd like, you know, just banging people in the back of the head.
Yeah.
And that's when our guys would just tap them on the shoulder and say, do that once more, Sonny, and you're out.
Which is a much better way of policing it all, really, I guess, yeah.
Apparently, they didn't have to ask the question too many times. Yeah.
No. Well, that's funny as well. You just brought up something that the third row in the audience was always where trouble happens, because people, for some strange reason, think if they're standing 3 rows back, you can't see them from the stage. For some reason, they believe they're invisible.
Yes.
And, you know, it's kind of not the case. But, yeah. So that, yes, so I do remember that concert, Russell, in a vague manner, and I hope it didn't spoil too many people's enjoyment of the evening. Curious Creatures is created and presented by Vol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Spare.
Social media, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
I love saying www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com. And you can reach us on Instagram, Facebook, at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram and at doubleelvisfm on Twitter. Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2021.